Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Roger Luckhurst, the Jeffrey Tillotson Professor of 19th Century Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. And we're continuing our discussion about his book, Gothic, An Illustrated History. Roger, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
It's always great to come back and talk to you, Mark.
Now, tonight, there's a section of your book, and I have to admit, when I first came across it, as I was reading through, it's titled The Gothic Compass, and that you took each of the cardinal directions and then talked about the Gothic sort of symbolism and Gothic ideas about that. And it was unexpected to me. I have no idea why. How did you come up with that idea? Because it ends up being a very interesting idea.
Yeah.
Like, I think you could write a whole book on it.
Yeah, you kind of could, yeah. So I wanted to do something about how the Gothic is associated with the North, and that's historically where it's been located. You know, the Goths come from the North. They come sweeping down and destroy Roman civilization. And there's a lot of work in the 19th century which actually really racializes that idea as well, so that the Gothic literature is somehow tied to the kind of wastes of the North and the tribes of the North. But then I kind of, you know, was aware that actually there's a Southern Gothic, obviously famously in the States. And in the late 19th century, there was a Yellow Peril idea, which was, you know, the East was a place where horror was coming from. And then, you know, you read Cormac McCarthy and Blood Meridian, his greatest novel, I think, is subtitled The Evening Redness in the West. So that kind of idea of north, south, east, west then came to me as a sense of, well, maybe we could, I literally want to orient the reader in how to kind of map the Gothic. And actually you can do it with the compass rose.
It's fascinating because it also reveals a lot of the racial impulses or the racial attitude impulses. And that was fascinating. But I'll have to tell you, first and foremost, you have to ask yourself, where did the word Gothic come from?
Yeah, so it's associated with these tribes that were located in the kind of Russian steppes, I guess, that were coming down the Danube. So they were kind of a tribe that was expanding in the 3rd century AD. And what's unusual about it, I guess, is that they're slowly moving down the Danube and people can see what's happening. They see what's coming. It's a kind of a force. A new kind of virile tribal kind of energy, warlike energy coming from this kind of place. And in a way, the Roman Empire is on its last legs. It's exhausted. It's kind of fractured and overstretched. And there's a sort of grim inevitability about the path that these Goths are going to take. And they were split into East and West. So you get Visigoths and Ostrogoths. But they're all kind of painted by late Roman writers with this strong sense of they have supernatural powers.
Right.
The witches can cause eclipses. There are horrible signs of, you know, severed limbs kind of writhing and all kinds of apocalyptic visions. So it's a kind of sense of anticipatory dread that the Goths are kind of coming. And I think that's that's why this term was picked up and used. I mean, initially, it was just for the Dark Ages as a whole. So that kind of sense of we've plunged into the Dark Ages because the Goths have destroyed civilization. And it's only really in the 19th century you start to get a bit more specificity to that idea of the Goths coming from the North and perhaps being associated with all kinds of aspects of Northern culture.
But did the term sort of fall out of use and then sort of come back in the 19th century? I mean, when did people start writing like the Gothic novel in Britain?
Yeah, so I mean, the Gothic is a term that's used by the Romans, but actually for a literature or a culture of the Gothic, we talk about the Gothic Revival, which is very much an 18th century term. And at that point, Gothic kind of means, well, all of the medieval period, really. They're a bit vague about it. And then there's something strange and mercurial happens with the term, which it begins to be associated with this kind of supernatural popular literature, slightly disreputable literature in the 1760s. But then you also get a very positive spin on it. So the Gothic Revival architecture, it's why lots of architecture in Victorian England is in the Gothic Revival style. So, like, you know, the Houses of Parliament famously was rebuilt in a kind of Gothic style. So it's a mock medieval style. And it's not something that they're frightened of. They actually think that that represents something true about the North and about England and about continuity and tradition. So there's a great anxiety about the modern world and the speed of change in the 19th century. So they really start to prop in this idea of, well, maybe if we can go back to certain set of Gothic ideals, this represents safety and kind of continuity. So it begins to develop this kind of split meaning in the 19th century, which always drives my students crazy, because as soon as you define it in one way, it means precisely the opposite as well. And that's often how Gothic narratives go. They kind of have this dreamlike logic where one thing turns into another.
Well,
and I just have, you know, I always have to say, just relax. It can mean many things at the same time.
Well, what propelled this association of the term or the idea of Gothic with the uncanny and the sort of damp and weird? It seems like it was propelled mostly by novels in the 19th century.
It is partly to do with the novel form, and also just that sort of sense of, if you think about the 18th century and the 19th century at the beginning of modern idea of the nation state. So, you know, you're beginning to get the formation of Germany or formation of Italy and Europe. They're coming together as one kind of nation. A lot of these new nation states are looking desperately for a kind of tradition that they can root themselves in. So particularly in Germany, the Grimm brothers famously went around and collected lots of really these Grimm, gruesome,
first of all,
narratives.
They were born into that name.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they were perfect for it.
They
went around collecting all of these oral kind of stories. And in a way, that became the kind of national treasure house of kind of stories. And it's the same in Scandinavia and in, you know, the so-called Teutonic North, as they thought about it in the 19th century. So that includes Anglo-Saxons in Germany, but also across Northern Europe into the UK. They all start kind of getting really interested in these ideas of Scandinavian sagas. These were collected and written up in the 13th century, and that's where we get all of those, you know, Loki and the Northern gods and the Norns and all these, the trolls. All of this kind of iconography is kind of swimming around. And for many people, say like the really important Victorian writer John Ruskin, he always said that actually the Gothic equals the virility and the energy of the North. And this is what ties us together against the evil Catholic south of Europe, which is, you know, indolent and lies around in the sun and doesn't think spiky thoughts or build spiky buildings. He's very much kind of passionately attached to this idea of a racialized North, and it's rooted across this kind of northern idea of, which is broadly a fantasy, but an idea that stretches from Scandinavia through Germany into England and then on to Iceland.
It's fascinating reading your book about the idea of the far North. And one of the things that I read in your book is that peoples of the North were feared. But the weirdest one thing to me was that the Norsemen feared the Sami people who are from Finland. And it just strikes me as so weird. Here's the Norsemen who are probably feared by the Scots and the Irish because of their plunders, but they're fearing the people that are further north.
That's right. Yeah, there's always somewhere further on that is way worse.
Yeah.
Than you. So there's always another kind of place in the north. So in the UK, the Romans built Hadrian's Wall. You know, it's kind of a marker of the absolute outer limit of the of the empire. But beyond that wall, you know, they were, you say, if you go there, you die within 30 minutes. It's full of terrifying creatures and monsters, and, of course, the Scottish.
I was going to say.
And that, kind of, and that kind of sense of it. And you see that all the way through down to things like Game of Thrones. You
know, right. Where, I mean, Game of Thrones just lifted this idea right out of the tradition.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, George R. R. Martin is famous for kind of really rooting all of his mythologies in, you know, found text from, particularly from the north, you know, so that idea of the wildlings beyond the Great Wall, or even an army of the undead, which is what ultimately comes from the north. Winter is coming, it's yeah. coming from the north. That idea, it's all absolutely rooted in this idea of a Gothic north.
What I love about your book throughout, is that there's always references that you make to contemporary, either fiction or films. And we were talking about the North and the strange traditions. You quote a Polish journalist who said reality in the North is thinner than anywhere else. But you show the movie Midsommar, 2019 film. That's a classic idea that the people in the North are odd or strange and violent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a classic kind of folk horror of recent years, and that's about a group of American anthropologists, very, you know, kind of privileged, self-obsessed anthropologists who've been invited to go to this far northern ceremony, and it's rooted in kind of folklore of Sweden, in the far north. So Ari Aster, the director, I think he wrote a 100-page kind of tract, which was all about the mythology that he'd invented for this kind of place. And of course, it's where, you know, the sun is no longer setting because it's midsummer, and things get weirder and weirder and odder and more gruesome for this group of anthropologists who are, of course, picked off one by one. It gets increasingly kind of baroque in its imagination. And that's a perfect example of how the imagination of the Gothic is literally hundreds of years old. You know, it's kind of rooted in this idea of there is something really bad in the woods far north, beyond the bounds of civilization. This wilderness is a place where horrible things will happen.
Glenn Gould, the composer and piano player from Canada, one of his most famous productions for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation radio was a piece he called The Idea of North.
Yeah.
And it was really fascinating. Again, still harping on that idea that the North holds a weird place in our minds, a weird dreams. And then there were all those doomed, fateful expeditions to the North to add to it.
Yeah.
But let's switch to the South,
okay.
Which part of it is a little bit like the North. when you read and you quote Poe and the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, that's a very weird story for Poe even. And it's a fragmentary, and we talked about fragments last time. It's an example of fragmental writing. For people who've never read it, can you just talk about it for about a minute?
Yeah, sure. It's a story that Poe was commissioned to write in 1838, and he wrote three parts, and it doesn't finish. That's the amazing thing about it. So that it's a narrative of a voyage that goes increasingly further south and gets more and more strange and unsettling and unnerving. And in a way, he works through a whole series of kind of stereotypes. So, you know, you end up in an island full of cannibals, you escape from that, you encounter savage Indian races and so on. But then it gets really kind of metaphysical because he's heading towards the Antarctic. And of course, in 1838, no one has been there.
Right,
no one knows
right.
which is there. So in a way, it ends exactly right, which is in the white blank space where you can't represent anything because you've gone beyond the bounds of what is known. So this is a kind of wonderful invitation for other people to kind of come in and try and fill out that sort of space. So, you know, virtually exactly 100 years later, H.P. Lovecraft writes this story at the Mountains of Madness in the Antarctic. And that, in a way, is trying to imagine into the blank space of Poe's story. This is often how the Gothic works, is that, you know, you have a wonderfully influential text because it's a fragment that invites other people to try and complete complete it, and that's what Lovecraft was doing with Poe.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Roger Luckhurst. He's the Geoffrey Tillotson Professor of 19th Century Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. And we're continuing our discussion of his book, Gothic, An Illustrated History. Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And I especially refer to the Gustave Doré illustrations for that. That idea of the antipodes, the idea that you're going to the opposite spot at the end of the world is amazing. And again, the movies mention your book, The Thing, is a classic example. Now, that's on the global scale, but as you talked in the introduction, there are these regional differences too, like the Deep South and Southern Gothic here in North America. And people, and you can think of, again, movie reference would be Deliverance, 1972. But a place of dismal swamps and tangled family histories. And then it gets even weirder in your book, if that's possible, because you have these crazed Cajuns, and then eventually you have zombies and voodoo and Marie Laveau and the vampires of Anne Rice. I mean, it's amazing when you think about that idea of the Gothic South.
Yeah, and I really like the idea that, you know, we I think most people know that term, Southern Gothic, but actually it was coined in order to try and kill off this ridiculous literature that was emerging in the 1930s, which the person who coined the phrase Southern Gothic was trying to just say, well, don't read any William Faulkner, that's a load of old rubbish. And it's full of, you know, these blood and bones and all of this horrifying ghostly imagery. And of course people went, that sounds great, I need more of that. And loads of people kind of pile in, and it becomes a genre of its own, as you say. So you can follow it through Deliverance, but also, you know, up to the present day with things like True Blood in the South, Charlene Harris's vampire novels, where vampires are sort of integrated into society, but it's full of people who want, you know, racial purity. You can see that it's kind of really harping on some of those core Gothic ideas about, you know, there's always some anxiety about an invasion from somewhere else, whether it's north, south, east, or west, that's going to undo your identity, that's going to threaten you in some kind of way. And so that, you know, you see that in every single cardinal point of the compass, is that there's something on the other side, something from further on that is eating at the edges of your identity.
And it reveals so much about the peoples that are having that imagination too. Like, let's talk about the East for a second. And I love what you bring up. I mean, this whole idea of Orientalism and imperialism. But it starts pretty close in the Middle East with things like the mummy, and then with the Far East with Sax Rohmer's Fu Manchu, which is an amazing racist image. But it's the idea of the sort of the weird, wily Asians, the weird, wily Chinese, which, by the way, was exhibited here in the west of North America, where there were all these stories about the Chinese immigrants, which were just horrible. But again, it was this fascination about the East.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the latest film, Train Dreams, is partly haunted. The whole thing is haunted by the killing of a Chinese railway worker early in the century. So that's kind of a good example. Yeah, I mean, this was one of the ways into this whole idea of thinking about orientation, because you can take the East and move it progressively from where I am in London. You can divide London between West and East, of course, and East London in the late 19th century was this kind of den of iniquity, and it was full of, you know, that's where Jack the Ripper was taking place, it's where Jekyll and Hyde is partly set, you know, it's this awful kind of unknown terrain. So they literally divided the city in half. And then, of course, the Gothic is driven by a sort of sense of, well, there's the Western Europe, but also there's Eastern Europe. And someone like Count Dracula is coming edge of Christian Europe, and even talks, the Count himself talks about having been on this borderland between the East and the West, between Christian and Islamic culture, and moving between these boundaries. And vampires and mummies, in fact, come just from over the border, just in that eastern kind of terrain, that sort of world of either the Ottoman Empire or of Egypt, ancient Egypt. So you get that. And then you can move further and, so, as you say, talk about the Far East and this idea of the horrifying things going on in India.
Oh, yeah.
So the big colonial kind of imagination about this.
Thuggy cults. Thuggy cults.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the thuggies who were, you know, this kind of strange secret society who would strangle white settlers. And there was a huge campaign to kind of seek them out and kill them off in the 1830s. And that became a very kind of, you know, it was all part of the British fevered imperial imagination of the East. And that's before you even get to, you know, the notorious cruelty, so-called, of China and Japan, right, and those kind of threatening empires becoming really threatening the late 19th century as kind of rival powers as they began to open up their trade. So you get these kind of fever dreams like Fu Manchu by Sax Roma, you know, he was really big also and taken over by Hollywood from quite early on. You know, in the 1910s, you were getting adaptations of this rather evil genius of a Oriental master.
Well, even in a Bond film like Dr. No.
Totally. Yeah.
But
yeah,
what's, and I'm going to squeeze this in because we're going to run out of time. For me, what's really fascinating, and you do write about this in the book, is that especially Japan and Korea have their own Gothic traditions. And I think some of the wildest horror movies that are being filmed today are either in Japan or Korea. And that tradition, I know in Japan, goes back to the Edo period, where they would have these series of prints of 100 hungry ghosts and all sorts. But there's a whole other I don't know if Gothic is the right word, but there's a whole thing of horror and weirdness that's a tradition in Gothic and Korea that's very active today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they have their own kind of internal traditions. You're quite right. They're hundreds of years old and a very rich kind of mythology of supernatural creatures. But it's also always worth asking, you know, where is the most kind of vibrant culture of kind of horror or the Gothic emerging and why? So my theory is always that it kind of follows power, that it's kind of a shadow, the Gothic, of kind of colonial power. So in the 19th century, it's Great Britain. In the 20th century, it's America. But in the 21st century, what you're getting from these really hyper-capitalist societies like Korea, South Korea, and also Japan, and also China too now, is a kind of sense that the Gothic is trying to address some of the anxieties and the fears of this rapid transformation and change, the forgetting of tradition, the erasure of the past, the arrival of all new kind of elements that are infiltrating into traditional cultures. That's why they become pressure cookers that deliver up these extraordinary kind of amazing kind of horror films. I agree that, you know, it's Japan and South Korea that are producing some really truly extraordinary fictions at the moment.
When you think of movies like Audition and The Grudge, which you write about in the book, I mean, the Audition in particular has got absolutely moments that are really visceral horror and Gothic impulses.
Yeah, Audition really isn't for the faint-hearted. but something like The Ring, which is incredibly frightening, which was a Japanese film from 1998 about haunted cassette tape. If you watch it, you're going to die.
And then that was made into an American or British edition.
Right. There's a whole kind of array of Japanese films that have been remade by Hollywood, you know, Dark Water, The Grudge, all of The Ring cycle. And that's an indication, perhaps, of their kind of potency, their power. They don't quite carry over into a different context. It's always worth watching the originals because they're coming from this particular moment, this particular place.
We're not going to have time to talk about the West, and you've written a lot about the West in this book.
Sure.
But I want to mention a thank you because this is the first book I've ever read in my entire long life that actually writes about Billy the Kid versus Dracula and Jesse James meets Frankenstein. I can't believe those movies were cited in your book. I mean, it's all those really good other movies too, but I can't believe I've read that. That was just hilarious to me. And also, thank you citing Tremors. Tremors is a I think an underappreciated film.
Yes. Do you know that there are 7 sequels to Tremors?
I know, and I couldn't believe that. I loved the original movie with Kevin Bacon, but I can't believe that there are 7 sequels to that. But I think a classic gothic western is No Country for Old Men. The film is absolutely fantastic. And again, one of the deep pleasures of your book is to be able to come across literature, artwork, and then film cited throughout the book. And we're also not going to have time to talk about planetary and cosmic horror, which really, that's like, that could be another entire book when you cite Twin Peaks, Arrival. Oh my God. H.P. Lovecraft, of course. But what an amazing book this is. This is actually, although this may look like an entertaining book, it's actually a serious, like, university level study of Gothic.
Well, yeah, I mean, I try and make it as accessible as possible, because everyone has academic writing. But, I wanted it to be as open as possible and to kind of invite people in from as low culture as you could possibly think of to as high culture as you might, Wagner all the way to Bubba Hotep.
That's a great film, too. I like Billy the Kid versus Dracula.
All that, yeah.
We're completely out of time. Obviously, we could talk about this book for months. My returning guest tonight is Roger Luckhurst, the Jeffrey Tillotson Professor of 19th Century Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. And we've been discussing his book, I Can't Recommend This Enough, Gothic in Illustrated History. Roger, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's always a delight to talk to you, Mark. And this enthusiasm is great. It really, really matters to an author that someone responds so well. So
you deserve it. The work's in the book, and it's great. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.